From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, we've had some terrific theatrical performances live in the Insight studio this year. Later in the show, we'll listen again to some of the highlights. But first, what kind of movie year was 2008? Which films were the best and worst? And how does 2009 look for film fans? Joining me are Sacramento film critics Carla Meyer of the Sacramento Bee and Jim Lane of the Sacramento News and Review. Carla, Jim, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thanks.
Well, we'll start with what kind of movie year was 2008? Good, bad, indifferent, and what made it that? Carla?
I would say on the whole it was pretty good but not exceptional. And what made it that, what I always think is so many times you wait until the awards season, until the fall, and you think that that's when all these movies that are going to come out that are being positioned for awards consideration are going to usurp the ones that came before them. And they didn't really end up usurping them. They were, a lot of them were very, very well done, but there weren't very many really extraordinary films.
I see. And what about you, Jim? What do you make of the year?
I would go a little more towards the indifferent, but indifferent. The top end of indifferent and the bottom end of good. At the same time, I have to include a caveat in that. The last month, I've been occupied with other projects and haven't been able to keep up on some of the late award season films. I haven't yet seen Slumdog Millionaire or Milk, both of which I understand are excellent films, and I've heard nothing but good about them. I'm looking forward to seeing them, and I hope I can get to them before I have to put them in my Netflix queue. But otherwise, there wasn't a lot of movies that I was excited about. That people would ask me, what's the good movie out there now? And I would sort of troll up whatever the best one I saw recently was, but there was never, hardly ever, one this year that I said, you've just got to go out and see this one.
Well, Jim, given your caveat of some notable films that you haven't seen, what's your favorite film, top film of the year so far in movies?
I would go with two films, one of which was completely ignored, and the other of which I think was kind of underrated. The underrated one was Get Smart. I thought it was one of the best and funniest and most sharply made movies of the year. The other one that I think was almost completely forgotten, if it was noticed at all, was a documentary called Young at Heart, which was about a troupe of elderly singers. The average age, I think, was 76 or 77, who toured various institutions on the East Coast, singing songs by The Clash,
just songs Sex you wouldn't
Pistols,
expect them.
Exactly, that kind of Should I Stay or Should I Go? And it was a very touching, very moving film where the Grim Reaper was always in the background, and in fact, some of the performers died during production, others between production and release. So it was, at the same time, it was a very heartening and very poignant film that I think deserved a lot more attention than it got.
We're talking about the films of 2008. That's Jim Lane of the Sacramento News and Review, Carla Meyer at the Sacramento Bee. What about you? What was your best film of the year?
My favorite film of the year was The Visitor, which is sort of a quiet, independent drama starring Richard Jenkins, who is a longtime character actor who got his first really big starring role. And the film is by Tom McCarthy, who did The Station Agent. And it's just a really wonderful, just from start to finish, film in terms of being observational. And it's about a professor who's a widower who has lost his zest for life. And he has to go into the city to an apartment he keeps there. And he finds that there are two illegal immigrants living in his apartment because they've been duped into renting it. And he gets involved in these people's lives. And it's just a very touching and very sort of true film and very nice looking for an independent film. It's just my favorite kind of film. I like a really well-made independent drama.
Well, Jim gave us two movies. Do you have a second place film or a close second or otherwise?
I have three, probably, and I would have to say they're tied, really. But I would say WALL-E, which I loved, and which is definitely among the very best films of the year, but you don't often have people, have people including animation, but the animation in this is just incredible. Just, you know, the Pixar artistry is just they're just at the top of their game. And it's just visually the most wondrous thing I've seen all year. And also, you know, Milk and Slumdog Millionaire, I would say. Those are my runners up.
There will be some adults who hear Pixar, WALL-E, animation. Not for me. It's for families. It's for kids. What about adults who have no kids?
Oh, I would go to see that. Oh, definitely. Because it's the first 30 minutes of it are basically wordless, and it's hyper realistic in terms of, or photorealistic, and it's almost as if it's not even animated. It's like the animation is that great, but that makes it sound like, well, why bother then? But it makes it it's set on Earth, and it's sort of post apocalyptic world, and it's just showing a robot's adventures for about the first 30 minutes of the film, and it's one of the most incredible sequences I've ever seen in any film.
Wow. Jim, do you have any comments on these movies or any others you'd like to add as things to consider?
It's my understanding, the thing that struck me most about WALL-E, and I'm not sure what my source on this was that it wasn't entirely animated, that it was in fact a blend of animation and some live action backgrounds. And if that's the case, it would make sense because, as Carla says, much of it is so photorealistic. If so, I think that may make WALL-E the wave of the future for films. There may be more and more of that sort of thing, where you see these seamless blends of computer animation and live action films, but live action filming. But whatever the source of it was, it was a case of Pixar simply doing it again. They raised the bar higher than anybody can reach except themselves on their next film. I don't know how they do it, but they do it. And I was also, I share Carla's admiration for The Visitor. It's a very well done little film, and I say that in the best possible way and most respectful way. And it also gives a rare chance for one of the most familiar actors in films, Richard Jenkins, to really carry a film by himself.
Carla, in July, in your blog at sacb.com, you said it's midway through 2008, and you said the two best films so far this year, WALL-E and The Visitor, and I can't help but noticing it's the end of the year, and your top two films remain the same.
I've never had my blog quoted before, so thank you. I have, exactly, and that's the thing I was saying. You always think that by the end of the year that those movies will be supplanted somehow, because one came out in April, and it was a very small movie, and the other one was obviously a summer animated film, and they weren't. And so, you know, as much as you tend to go with the most recent, because that's just human nature, what you've seen most recently that's good in terms of when I was doing my top 10 list. But I thought I didn't like them. I did not like any other movie better than those two, really. Although Slumdog Millionaire and Milk are very, very good films.
Well, speaking of Milk, the San Francisco Film Critics Circle named Milk the best picture of the year. And Carla, you're a member of the San Francisco Film Critics Circle, but you made Milk number three of your films of the year in the Bee's summary of such matters in yesterday's paper. So I guess you disagreed with some of your cohorts on the San Francisco Film Critics Circle.
Oh, it's a long process when you're voting for those things. And it's not as if, you know, there's, I think, 24 people. And so I didn't disagree with them when it came down to the top contenders. So it was just more, I can't even remember exactly what the process was, but I think Milk is a wonderful film.
Sure. Milk, of course, is set in San Francisco. Was there some rooting for the home team, you think, in this?
I think there was actually, it was funny because there was definitely rooting for the home team in terms of being a great movie that was made in San Francisco. But there was also some rooting for, well, gosh, if we give, I don't know if I should tell the ins and outs of the voting, but basically it was definitely not the primary factor.
Okay. Jim Lane, what was the worst film that you saw in 2008?
Oh, that's easy. And it's out there now. It's called 7 Pounds with Will Smith. It is a film. It would insult the intelligence of a head of cabbage. It's It is by far the worst film of the year. I mean, there's not even, to me, there's not even a close contender. It simply does not make sense or even a convincing fantasy for 5 seconds at a time.
Carla?
Well, in sort of in defense of 7 Pounds, I think it was well-intentioned but terribly done, whereas some films are just horrible from start to finish and they don't really even care. They think, well, we're going to make some money anyway. Like, I would say there was a movie much earlier in the year, and for me, there's like two rules of thumb, and one is like, nothing with Matthew McConaughey is going to be good and nothing with Kate Hudson is going to be good. And so they were together in a movie called Fool's Gold, and they really proved me right on that one. And that's just, there's no one's even trying. It's slapdash. With 7 Pounds, it was, the problem with it is that they're keeping you in the dark for over an hour. And then when you get to what it is, to what this big mystery is, it's very unsatisfying. And so what I can see what they tried to do, and I give those films more of a break than just the trash they put out there.
What about the big hit movies of the year? WALL-E was one of the biggest grossing films of the year, but what about the others in the top six? The Dark Knight, Iron Man, Indiana Jones, Hancock, Kung Fu Panda. Any of those stand out as being particularly better as a film than the others, Jim?
The ones that you mentioned that stand out most, the one that stands out most to me is Iron Man. I thought that was, if you have to make comic book movies, I think that's the kind of movie you should make. And especially because with all of the flash and with all of the flash and computer generated effects, and it does finally get down to the battle of the Supermen, the superhero and the supervillain at the end, which is getting to be kind of a cliche, let's face it. But still, it had a lot of vigor and elan, and it also had really, really fine performances from Robert Downey Jr. and Gwyneth Paltrow. A really nice, playful, semi-sexual chemistry going between the two of them that I think put it over the top.
What about you, Carla? Which of the blockbusters did you like the most?
Did I like the most of those? Well, WALL-E, obviously, but I'd say it would be a tie between, I liked Iron Man. I thought Iron Man's special effects were not very good. So, I mean, at some point, And I did love the interplay between Gwyneth Paltrow and Robert Downey Jr. And I just love Robert Downey Jr. He just brings something extra to every role. And in Tropic Thunder as well. He's amazing in that. But when it comes down to it, though, those movies, the action scenes have to be there. And I didn't think that they were. I don't think there was anything else on the list that I was particularly wowed by.
Speaking of The Dark Knight, Heath Ledger was in it. That was the last film that he made. Do you think he's heading straight towards getting the Best Supporting Actor Oscar because A, he's dead, B, larger than life character, C, no major competition? Does that seem reasonable, Jim?
I think there is a certain amount of, shall we say, necrophilia involved in that, yes. Although I think he gave a fine performance. For my money, the Best Supporting Actor of the year was Mark Strong in, I have drawn a complete blank, Body of Lies. When he played the head of the Jordanian intelligence service, and it takes something to steal a film from Leonardo DiCaprio and Russell Crowe, and he managed to do it. So I do think, yes, Heath Ledger may be the front runner for Best Supporting Actor, but I don't think it's because there's no reasonable competition.
Carla, Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight?
I think it's just sort of inevitable. I think that he was a fantastic actor, and there's just the fascination with the film after his death. And, you know, the performance is just really a bang-up performance. So I don't think that there's no competition per se, but this year, because of the circumstances, there really essentially is no competition.
Carla Meyer, film critic for the Sacramento Bee. Jim Lane with the Sacramento News and Review. We're talking about the movies of 2008. I'd like to hear what you both think is or even were the most surprising movies of 2008. One I'd like to put out there would be Tropic Thunder, which got two nominations in the Golden Globes for Best Supporting Actor. Not the kind of movie you'd have thought would get that kind of recognition. Carla, what do you think?
Well, I think it has to do with there not being all of these end-of-the-year films not wowing like they were maybe meant to do. Also, the Golden Globes has about 60 categories. So I think that, you know,
everything gets a shout-out.
Everything gets a, yeah. And but, you know, Robert Downey Jr., I can't remember who else was
Tom Cruise.
Oh, that's absolutely ridiculous. That's just a cartoonish performance. But Robert Downey Jr. is just incredible in Tropic Thunder. And Tropic Thunder is a very memorable film. It is a really, really, you know, un-PC. But given the circumstances and how you feel about his performance, it's just undeniable that his performance, you know, he's playing an actor who's gone deep into character as an African-American character. And however you know, view the circumstances of his performance, the performance is just out of this world. And I would say it's probably better than Heath Ledger's. And Heath Ledger's is great, but his performance is fantastic.
Jim, most surprising movie of the year?
I'd have to say, for me, the most surprising movie of the year is the one that most people didn't like. I'm not sure what Carla thought of it, but it didn't get very good reviews, and that was Hancock. I thought that was quite different from what I expected, and it was not a film that gave away everything in the trailer, which it seemed to do. So that was the most surprising to me. Tropic Thunder, I expected to be funny. I didn't expect it to be particularly disciplined, and I expected it to be something that you wouldn't want to take the kids to see, although some people did have kids at the screening I saw. But that didn't surprise me. Tropic Thunder was more or less what I expected. And Robert Downey Jr., again, I was just looking at one of the magazines in your green room here. It talks about him as the most amazing comeback of the last 10 years, and that has to be true.
Yeah. Let's talk about some trends in movies and the movie business. One that we've touched on so far is that the end of the year, prestige, high-quality films haven't quite lived up to their usual billing. Jim, do you think this is just a fluke that the end of the year of 2008 didn't really work out the way one expects? Or do you think there's some overall trend here?
I don't know if you can really consider it a trend. But it is true that there doesn't seem to have been the flood of award-worthy movies that people usually expect after Thanksgiving. And when we're talking about Sacramento theaters rolling into the middle of January, that doesn't seem to be happening. And it could be just, you know, it could be just a temporary thing. You know, if present trends continue, well, present trends never continue because that's why they're trends. But I don't know that you can generalize anything from it, but it's part of why I found 2008 to be kind of a disappointment.
Carla, was the writer's strike a part of this, do you think?
You know, it's hard to say because you think so, because there are movies that were pushed back or their production didn't start because of the writer's strike. However, I don't think that in terms of numbers, there were fewer of these Hollywood awards films. They just weren't, like a lot of them, I would say, just for an example, Doubt, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, they're good movies. They're just not, they just don't make that leap to really the awards contention or the, you know, to great actually. And so I'm not sure if the writer's strike had anything to do with it. I don't think so. I think it's just that they weren't that good. The movies weren't as good as they usually are. You usually have maybe in terms of trying to figure out your best picture list, if you have five choices for a best picture list, there's usually a lot more contenders than there were this year.
And finally, Jim and Carla, what movies are you looking forward to next year? And we can include in that movies that have opened but haven't yet opened in Sacramento. Carla?
Oh, well, Wendy and Lucy, which is a very small film that comes out. It has come out, I think, in a few cities for awards consideration. It comes out here in February. Very small film, very observational, but it's about a young woman played by Michelle Williams, who was in Brokeback Mountain, and who is kind of on the fringe and is driving to Alaska to go work at the fisheries there, and has going to Alaska and gets stuck in Portland and loses her dog, and then just a lot of mishaps or really unfortunate events occur. And it's just about these people that are about people who are kind of live on the edge. And there's many more of those people these days, and how close you a person can be toward just homelessness.
And this you listed in your top 10 films of the year in the paper.
Yeah. It's very well acted, and it's mostly Michelle Williams, and boy, she's incredible. She's just completely another person, you know. And I love that when people do that, and not another person that is famous. That's not, you know, it's not Ray Charles, but is just this person that you have come in contact with, these, you know, these kinds of people, just sort of aimless, doesn't have a lot of foundation, doesn't have family, and needs to make it somehow, and is trying.
And Jim, any particular film you're looking forward to?
I'm particularly looking forward to Wendy and Lucy myself, mainly because I'm a huge fan of Michelle Williams, and I can't wait to see her. She seems to have been the best supporting actress in every movie I've seen her in, so I'm looking forward to seeing her carry a movie of her own, which I think she can do and is long overdue for the opportunity.
Okay. Well, thank you both so much. That's Jim Lane, film critic for the Sacramento News and Review. Carla Meyer, film critic for the Sacramento Bee. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Jeffrey, and Happy New Year.
Thank you. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, we've had some terrific theatrical performances live in the Insight studio this year. We'll listen again to some of the highlights. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did you disagree with something you heard on Insight? Tell us what it was and why at insight@capradio.org. Tomorrow in Insight, we'll listen again to some of our favorite conversations of this year, including Fresh Air's Terry Gross. You'll also hear comedian and actor Carlos Alazraki, best known for his role in Reno 911 and his voice work like the Taco Bell Chihuahua. And journalist Gustavo Arellano, author of the weekly syndicated column Ask a Mexican. We love having performers on Insight. They usually make for interesting, outgoing guests. And we especially like it when they perform in our studio. Let's listen again to some of our favorite theater performers on Insight this year. In January, there was a new musical by Sacramento composer Greg Coffin. Right Next to Me is about three pairs of people trying to make connections in a disconnected world. A local production was running at the B Street Theater. Greg Coffin and two cast members, Melissa Dye and Edward Watts, joined me. I asked Coffin to explain the title, which, by the way, is written all in lowercase, and the right next to is written as one long word.
It actually comes from the first song that I worked on for the piece, which is the idea of a space that is left there when a loved one goes.
Yeah. Give us a short description of what it's about.
About the show?
Yeah.
The show is about six different characters who are all in a crisis moment, and we come to learn how those six characters are related or interconnected or not. But it's basically each character is kind of the sourdough starter kit for the next character that's sung in the play. So the ideas of the play are woven lyrically from one character to the other. And then bit by bit, these characters start to take on relationships and problems and wind up to a conclusion at the end.
Let's talk with the two actors, Melissa Dye and Edward Watts. Melissa, you play three parts.
Yes,
who are they?
I play a flight attendant, and I play a mother who has a daughter who's recently left her husband, and an army wife whose husband is in Iraq, and she's sort of tortured by these nightmares and visions of him being killed over in Iraq.
The first song we'll hear is from Edward Watts. Mm-hmm. And who do you play?
I also have three characters as well, and they're all related to Melissa's characters. She mentioned a flight attendant, and she is married to, of all things, a marriage counselor. And their storyline revolves around the problems that they have with their marriage, oddly enough. The second character is a mailman, and he, unlike the other two sets of characters, the mailman does not have a relationship at the beginning of the show with the character of the wife. She has the mother, I guess. It's she has a young daughter, and the mailman has a young son who has been taken from him by his his wife that, who has left him. We could go into various reasons why at this point, but and then the third character is, of course, the army captain, the army man who is married to the woman who has been left behind in the States, and he's over there in Iraq.
Greg, how connected to each other are these three couples, the three pairs of people?
I think you're going to have to come to B Street and find that out.
That's a trade secret.
You didn't want me to give that away, did you?
Sorry. It's a secret recipe.
That's right.
Okay, well, that's fair enough. Ed, you're going to sing a song for us. What is it?
Yes.
Which character?
I'm privileged enough to sing the title song of the show right next to me. And this is a song that's sung by the mailman as he, and I guess I could set it up just a little bit.
Please.
He has been left by his wife who's taken the son, but through, you know, the course of the first act of the play, he has gotten the privilege of seeing his son. His son has come back to see him, or he's going to come back to see him. And one of the other central ideas of the show is everything is set within a big snowstorm that happens on this one street where all these characters sort of cohabitate a little bit. And there's a big sledding hill, and the sledding hill is something that he and his son having, you know, a yearly commitment to going and having a lot of fun on and sledding. And this is the song that he sings when he first sees it as he's out on his route, thinking about his son coming back for the first time to visit him.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing it.
Sure.
So this is Edward Watts singing, and he's accompanied by the pianist conductor of the show right next to me. He's Graham Sobelman. He's in our studio. Okay, let's hear it.
And as the snow comes down and blankets all the town, I cannot help but see your face in front of me. You shout out high and shrill, looked at the hill, the hill. Can you believe this snow? Let's grab the sled and go. We've waited one full year, but winter's finally here. We won't waste any time. We've got that hill to climb. We're chilled right to the bone. We've got skills to hone, how to distribute weight, how best to navigate. When you're in the driver's seat, do you steer with hands or feet? And halfway down the hill, we take a nasty spin. And you tumble right next to me. I miss you right next to me. So, buddy, get your rest. Promise to do your best. I'm calling Mom to see when you can visit me. So listen up in class. Don't give Mom any sass. I love you every day. We're gonna be okay. Your hill has brand new snow, but I promise I won't go until you're right next to me.
Singer, actor Edward Watts. We featured the musical he was in, Right Next to Me, in January. As it happens, the next day, Insight saw another of its theatrical highlights of the year, Top Dog, Underdog is a play about two African-American brothers with a love-hate relationship. They're trying to overcome their rivalry and reinvent themselves, but in very different ways. The play was written by Susan Laurie Parks and won the Pulitzer Prize in 2002. A local production was running at Sacramento Theatre Company. Director Benny Ambush and actors Hassan El Amin and Adrian Roberts joined me. I asked Ambush to explain the play's title.
Well, in part, it's about competition in the obsession to be number one, which is so much a part of the American ethic. People like being number one. They like being king of the mountain. And you've got sibling rivalry going on between these two brothers, Lincoln and Booth. And the balance of power shifts several times throughout the play.
And so the Top Dog, Underdog refers to this rivalry that you so often find within families when you've got two brothers, two sisters.
One's oh, you
top
bet. Dog, me and my underdog. Brother. Steve, yes.
Uh-huh. Well, you mentioned their names, Lincoln and Booth. And Hassan El Amin, you're Lincoln, correct?
Absolutely. I'm Lincoln.
And Adrian, you're Booth.
Yes, that's correct.
Now, these names are a bit of a joke, aren't they, really? Because Lincoln and Booth are historical figures who didn't have a very good relationship, to put it mildly. Hassan, could you tell us why they're called Lincoln and Booth?
Well, we'll find out in the play that it was the name that their father gave them, and it's explained that he did it as a joke. So it's kind of ironic, the outcome of the play, knowing the history of Lincoln and Booth, and then having us, the brothers, to be named that, and knowing that their father did it as a joke, but just what it entails historically, as well as what transpires between the two brothers.
And without banging it over the head, we're talking, of course, about President Abraham Lincoln, who was assassinated by John Wilkes Booth. Adrian, what do you think the two brothers make of being named after two men who are associated by murder?
You know, it's kind of hard to say, but I think at first maybe they didn't really think about it that much. But as they got older and have gone through school and stuff like that and learned their history, I think it kind of dawned on them that this is kind of a weird, you know, to have two siblings named Lincoln and Booth, given the history of the two men. So I think as they get older, they kind of think it's not a very nice joke. You know, sure. It's kind of, it puts a little, you know, a natural animosity between them that's going to be there anyway, you know, being brothers. But it's, you know, it heightens that animosity.
Benny, do you think the playwright Susan Laurie Parks wanted to suggest that this destiny was given to these two men by their names?
Well, there's an obvious setup, given that they're named the way they are. And given the fact that Lincoln, the character of Lincoln, actually has a job impersonating Abraham Lincoln at a carnival arcade, where tourists pay money to pretend to be John Wilkes Booth.
Oh, goodness.
And shooting Abraham Lincoln. And this is a black man playing Abraham Lincoln. So Susan Laurie Parks is using history and metaphor and images and kind of twisting them and turning them upside down on the head to provoke us a thought.
My guests are Hassan El Amin and Adrian Roberts. They're actors who play the characters of Lincoln and Booth in the play Top Dog, Underdog. Also with us, the director, Benny Ambush. Benny, we're going to hear a reading from the play. Could you tell us where we are in the play so that our listeners know where we are?
This is early in the play, inside their apartment, their cold water tenement, cramped, very small room, actually. It's not even an apartment. It's a room with no bathroom, no kitchen. The bathroom is way down the hall. And Lincoln has just come home from work. And they have the following encounter.
Okay.
My new name's Three Card. Three Card, got it? You wanted to know it, so now you know it. Three Card Monte by Three Card. Call me Three Card from here on out.
Three Card, shoot.
I'm getting everybody to call me Three Card. Grace likes Three Card Bed and Booth. She says Three Card's got something to it. Anybody not calling me Three Card gets a bullet.
You too much, man.
I'm making a point.
Point made, Three Card. Point made.
Oh, come on, man. We can make money, you and me. Throwing down the cards. Three Card and Link. Look out. We could clean up, you and me. You would throw the cards and I'd be your stick man. The one in the crowd who looks like just an innocent passerby, who looks like just another player, like just another customer, but who got intimate connections with you, the dealer, the one throwing the cards, the main man. I'd be the one who brings in the crowd. I'd be the one who makes them want to put their money down. You do your moves, I do mine. You turn your head, I turn the card.
It ain't easy as all that. There's more.
We could be a team, man. raking the money. Sure, there'd be some cats out there with fast eyes, some brothers and sisters who would watch real close and pick the right card. And there'd be some days when we would lose money. But most of the days, we would come out on top, pockets bulging, plenty of cash, and the ladies would be thrilling. You could afford to get laid. Grace would be all over me again.
I thought you said she was all over you.
She is. She is. I'm seeing her tomorrow, but today we gotta solidify the stuff twixt you and me. Big Brother Link and Little Brother Booth.
Three card.
Yeah. Scheming and dreaming. No one throws a card like you, Link. And with your moves and my magic, and we get Grace and a girl for you to round out the posse, we'd be golden, bro. Am I right? Am I right?
I don't touch the cards, three card. I don't touch the cards no more.
Actors Haseen El Amin and Adrian Roberts, who played the leads in a local production this year of the play Top Dog, Underdog. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, more theatrical performance highlights from the Insight studio this year. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can podcast Insight. Sign up at capradio.org/insight. Coming up this afternoon from Capital Public Radio News, a shelter opens in Rancho Cordova for locals who fear another natural gas explosion. That story and more later today on All Things Considered. We're listening again to some of our favorite theatrical performances on Insight this year. A gay-themed musical got its Sacramento premiere in July. Bare, spelled B-A-R-E, is about gay teens in a Catholic high school. The local production was by theatre company Artistic Differences. Director Kevin Carvalho and actors Ian Cullity and Lucas Blair joined me. I asked Carvalho to give us a quick summary of what Bare is about.
Well, Bare is much more than just two gay teens in love. It's basically a Catholic high school, and we have five main characters. And the main characters are Ivy, Nadia, Jason, Peter, and Matt. Nadia is kind of the social outcast of high school, and she's in love with the good guy, played by Matt. Matt's in love with the cheerleader homecoming queen, Ivy. Ivy's in love with the captain of the basketball team, Jason, and Jason happens to be in love with his roommate, Peter.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, Jason and Peter, or the actors who play Jason and
yes.
Peter, are with us. Let's start with Jason, the character Jason, played by Ian Cullity. Ian, welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
Tell us more about Jason. Who is Jason?
Jason is, for me, he's a guy who has always struggled with acknowledging who he really is. And he is, you know, liked and accepted at school. Everybody, you know, they want to be with him. They want to be around him. He has that sort of magnetic personality. And deep down, he's really struggling with who he really is. And he doesn't want to acknowledge it because of his family, because of the way he was brought up, because of his deep belief in his faith, which he holds very, very close to himself and who he is as a person. And so he's struggling with that and struggling with trying to come to grips with that.
And the actor who plays Peter is with us, Lucas Blair. Lucas, welcome.
Hello.
Tell us more about Peter.
Well, the character of Peter growing up has felt very confused. As a result of his confusion, he has felt that he was the reason for his parents' divorce. And his father doesn't play a very large role in his life. It's basically just him and his mother, and they both have a very strong relationship with each other and with God. But there's always something about their relationship that they both seem kind of timid about. And Peter is just very confused about himself and doesn't really find out that he's in fact gay until he is taken to a Catholic boarding school where he meets his roommate Jason. And everything just kind of starts to unfold from there.
You're also going to do a song for us. And as you get your microphone, Kevin, tell us, what's the song?
They're going to be singing the song Bare. It's actually the title song of the show.
Okay.
Do you remember the day that you met me? I swear it was yesterday. I knew with a glance that you were the question and you were the answer, that the world would make sense again if I held your hand. Someday you'll look back and I hope you'll remember the moment of truth when I knew who I was. How did I unlearn the truth you gave to me? I will always remember that first stolen moment. There you were kissing me, and time seemed to freeze. Now I stand at a crossroad, and I stare at the question. If prayer were the answer, I'd fall on my knees. But forward is calling, and I cannot stay here. A parting of souls as I try to move on. How do I forget the dream you shared with me? I've never been this bad. I've never been so scared.
I've never felt such honesty.
It will never go away.
Of such
peace.
Each
of us did
is
what it means to
me. Who we have to be.
Know as you hold my hand. It's not goodbye. The act is beginning, the audience waiting.
No, stay in this moment where secrets reveal. Here in a world where there's safety and falsehood, I have discovered the one thing that's real. That I love you, and I love you from the start. And if you hold that close to you, we'll never be apart. Peter, please know I love you from the start.
Singer, actors Ian Colletti and Lucas Blair. We featured the musical Bear on Insight in July. In April, we met Poetry Out Loud contestant Rashonda Betancourt of Roseville. She had won the state final and was going to represent California in the national Poetry Out Loud finals. I asked her to tell us what Poetry Out Loud is all about.
It's basically an organization that wants to tap into the youth of America and really get them more involved with poetry and the spoken word of it and the knowledge behind it, analyzing poems and understanding poems and the importance of poetry in youth, because it is very important and sometimes it gets overshadowed by sports or other activities that go on at school, but poetry can impact everyone's life.
Why do you think poetry is important?
You can relate to it in every way. Poetry heals, poetry can really tap into an audience, and it's not just meant to be read, but to be spoken. And I think that's the major difference in our schools, is it's not exactly, you know, we'll do a unit or two on poetry, but to actually do, you know, all year or a whole class, I think would change people's minds and really be beneficial to students.
You read three poems at the state finals, and you're going to read them in the national finals.
Yes.
Next week. And, of course, we have to hear you reading out loud.
Right.
What poem would you like to read?
I'll start with Sympathy.
Yes.
By Paul Laurence Dunbar.
Great.
Okay. I know what the caged bird feels. Alas, when the sun is bright on the upland slopes, when the wind stirs soft through the springing grass, and the river flows like a stream of glass, when the first bird sings and the first bud opes, and its faint perfume from its chalice stills, I know what the caged bird feels. I know why the caged bird beats his wing till its blood is red on the cruel bars. For he must fly back to his perch and cling when he fain would be on the bough a swing,
and a pain still throbs in the old, old scars, and they pulse again with a keener sting. I know why the cage bird beats his wing. I know why the cage bird sings. Ah, me. When his wing is bruised, and his bosom sore, and he beats his bars, and he would be free, it is not a carol of joy or glee, but a prayer that he sends from his heart's deep core, but a plea that upward to heaven he flings. I know why the cage bird sings.
Wow, Rashonda Betancourt reading out loud the poem Sympathy. Why did you choose that poem? You chose the poems yourself.
Right, I chose them myself. Yeah. And two of them have to follow certain guidelines of one has to be pre-20th century and the other has to be 20 lines or less. This followed through with my pre-20th century. They have plenty to choose from. They have an anthology of poems, about 500 poems. Paul Laurence Dunbar is an amazing poet, and he's really what attracted me. And I feel like, you know, everyone can kind of relate to this, you know, just feeling maybe that they don't have that freedom or can't get out. And I feel like I can relate to it. And it's a very strong poem. And I just wanted to get it out there. So
is it hard to read poems out loud? Now, I ask that because the language of poems is usually quite different from the language of speech. And I would guess that it's harder to read aloud than, say, a play or even a book.
Right. There is a lot behind poetry. And before I even recite these poems, I put them down and I analyze them and try and figure out what the poet is really trying to say. And then I have to get that out to an audience. So it is challenging, but I think it's that much more powerful when spoken.
Do you need to know what the poet is trying to say?
I think you do, in order to recite it and relay it to an audience. It's so much more different when you see it in front of you, when you hear it. It's just so much more powerful than just sitting by yourself and reading it. It's just amazing that way.
What if you couldn't figure out what the poet was really trying to say?
I think that you can also make different interpretations of it. You can, you know, the poem might not just mean one core thing. It can mean many things to different people in different situations.
I'd love to hear you read another one. I believe your favorite of the ones you do
is
Passing.
Passing.
Okay. Could you read that for us?
Yes. Passing by Toy Derricott. A professor invites me to his black lit class. They're reading Larson's Passing. One of the black students says, "Sometimes light-skinned blacks think they can fool other blacks, but I can always tell." Looking right through me. After I tell them I am black, I ask the class, "Was I passing when I was just sitting here, before I told you?" A white woman shakes her head desperately, as if I had deliberately deceived her. She keeps examining my face, then turning away, as if she hopes I'll disappear. Why presume passing is based on what I leave out and not what she fills in? In one scene in the book, in a restaurant, she's passing, though no one checked her at the door. "Hey, you black?" My father, who looked white, told me this story. Every year when he'd go to get his driver's license, the man at the window filling out the form would ask, "White or black?" Pencil poised without looking up. My father wouldn't pass, but he might use silence to trap a devil. When he didn't speak, the man would look up at my father's face. What did he write? My father quizzed me.
Poetry Out Loud contestant Rashonda Betancourt on Insight in April. We checked in with her soon after. While she didn't win the Nationals, she told us she had a tremendous experience visiting and competing in Washington, D.C. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producer was Lynn Weaver. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. And thank you for joining us. the next Insight, we'll listen again to some of our favorite conversations of this year, including Fresh Air's Terry Gross. You'll also hear comedian and actor Carlos Alazraki, best known for his role in Reno 911 and his voice work like the Taco Bell Chihuahua. And journalist Gustavo Arellano, author of the weekly column Ask a Mexican. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on KXJZ.